Islam. From 90.7 WFAE, this is a special edition of Charlotte Talks on the road at Dina's Place in Winthrop University's DiGiorgio Campus Center. I'm Mike Collins. I want to point out I had to prompt the audience for that. We're here because for the next several weeks, the Palmetto State will be the focus of the nation's attention as voters here play a key role in choosing the nominees that the Republican and Democratic parties will run for president. All the GOP candidates are in the state, and the nation's media has also descended upon South Carolina. They're following the candidates, sure, but they're also trying to take the temperature of the electorate. Well, who better to do that than people who live here? So this hour, we hear from some political experts, a journalist, and members of our audience here at Winthrop, actual potential voters in the South Carolina primary. Dr. Adolphus Belk is a political analyst and professor of political science and African American Studies program director here at Winthrop University and a frequent guest on Charlotte Talks. Welcome back.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Scott Huffman is also professor of political science and founder and director of the Social and Behavioral Research Laboratory at Winthrop. He's also director of and a collaborator with Dr. Belk on the Winthrop Poll Initiative. Thank you for joining us and welcome back.
Thank you.
And as an added bonus, we're also joined by WFAE's political reporter, Tom Bullock.
Thanks for having me.
Now, prior to going on the air, we had members of our audience answer this question, or we asked them to answer this question: what's getting you to the polls for this primary? In looking through the answers that I've gotten so far, not one of them tackled that question. But we will share with you the questions that they have raised themselves on these cards as we go through the show. I'll be reading them as we'll sprinkle them through. And we'll be opening our microphones to several people as well in the audience. And if you're listening here in the hall, or if you're at home listening, you can join the discussion on Twitter. Use the hashtag CTSCPrimary16. That's 1-6. CTSCPrimary16. And you'll get right to us here, and you can also email us or follow us on Facebook. Okay, let's start with last Saturday's debate in Greenville, and I want to get your very quick impressions of what turned out to be a raucous, combative, unlike anything I've ever seen before, debate. Was it unlike anything we've ever seen before? Only because we're talking about the modern era. If you went back to, say, the 19th century, would we have seen something like this?
Oh, we would have seen worse. We'd have seen fistfights. We'd have seen it taking literal days to vote. You'd come in, they'd be passing out whiskey. Our very first congressional elections, you had to go to the county seat in most places to vote. They were allowed for 2 or 3 days. There'd be stump speeches on a literal stump, whiskey, beer, fistfights. This was practically tame.
Yeah, when I think about,
however, it was a little more raucous than we've been used to in modern times.
When I think about the presidential contest in 1800, it was said, well, don't vote for Thomas Jefferson because he's the half-breed son of an Indian squaw and a mulatto. So, you know, smear and slander is not new. And then it was said about Martin Van Buren, well, he takes more baths than a real man should.
Well,
I thought someone said that on Saturday. So
I think that was Trump about Marco Rubio.
The pundits were almost apoplectic about this because it was so raucous, and Donald Trump was booed, and he would criticize the people booing him, and he criticize everybody on the stage.
Well, the only thing better than the media coverage of them behaving that way were the pundits going apoplectic on the shows afterwards.
So I guess my question is this. Because the electorate is obviously angry on both sides of the aisle and obviously frustrated, does this free-for-all that has become the Republican debates help them or hurt them? Because maybe it helps them. When you look at the Democratic debates, they're sedate.
But they're
speaking to the angry public out there, though?
They're also just two people. And that cannot be overstated. When you come to the Democratic debates, it really is just two people. I mean, you had three at the most. At one point with the Republicans, you had so many of them that basically they could have had two shows in Las Vegas running nightly. I mean, it was this never-ending series of the undercard and the overcard.
The only way to get press in those is to throw out an insult, a quip, and to start a brawl. I mean, when you only have two people on the stage, you know, even your worst attack is, that's not fair.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, on the Republican side, in order to get media attention on you, you have to question their parentage and whatever else.
Yeah, and I think part of this, too, is given where we are in this campaign, especially on the Republican side, I mean, let's face it, this has been, you know, again, I'll play another Rubio joke, one in eight Republicans is running for president. It sure seemed that way for quite a while. Now you're starting to see the field shrink and shrink and shrink. But in South Carolina, you have a moment where people know that there are only so many seats left on the train that takes you to Super Tuesday, which is on the 1st of March. There's only so much space for legitimate candidates. And this place, South Carolina, may very well be the place where certain candidates, regardless of exactly how they hope to do, they're going to have to come to terms with whether or not they are remaining viable.
You did a piece that aired earlier this week, Tom, about dirty politics in South Carolina. And South Carolina has a reputation of having fairly dirty political campaigns. Mm-hmm. Usually that's confined to the television commercials and a couple of other things. But does this idea of these raucous debates, and particularly the one in Greenville, play into the fact that there's an appetite for that, or maybe the appetite's not the right word, there is an acceptance of that in South Carolina?
Well, I think, first, I think one of the things that Dr. Huffman and I talk about is that, you know, Lee Atwater is from this state.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Lee Atwater was credited with being the brains behind the George H.W. Bush campaign for president in 1988. And Atwater understood very well that people sometimes don't vote based on what they think, but how they feel. And he tapped into sentiment with images and things of that sort. So that was something that he was very mindful of. And it's gone national. But when it comes back home, it takes on a special place. And if we look at the calendar, you know, we're out of New Hampshire, we're out of Iowa. By the time things turn to South Carolina, especially if you get a split coming out of Iowa and New Hampshire, the stakes are high. And when the stakes are high, people can get desperate. And that creates a situation where the environment is rather hospitable for a nasty campaign.
Yeah, and the ground is fertile for it here. But I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, and that's the anger of the electorate. And I think that's key to understanding what's going on. You know, in 2012, it was the first time on the Republican side when, you know, the person we voted for in South Carolina was not the nominee. Our streak had been broken. It used to be whoever South Carolina went for became the Republican nominee. And all of a sudden, we, quote, got it wrong. And I was among those who said, wow, we got it wrong. I wonder what that'll mean. I no longer think we got it wrong. I think South Carolina was the canary in the coal mine. That was the first place you saw conservative voters who were not only angry at Obama, but were angry at their own party establishment. And so they were turning against the party establishment candidate. And the reason I think we were ahead of the curve on that, that's what's happening everywhere in this cycle on the Republican side. And so you're seeing that, this raucous kind of debates. And what are they doing? They're expressing the folks' anger. So you have someone like Donald Trump coming in and saying, you know, terrible things about a former president who's still very popular down here. Is it going to do him harm? Not necessarily, because the people he's bringing into the electorate, he's bringing in because they're angry, and the people who were normal Republican voters beforehand who were behind Trump are completely down with the anger at the establishment, which we saw first here in 2012. Now you're seeing all across the country, but it happens to now have come to the crucible of South Carolina, where anger meets a history of dirty politics.
Let's talk a bit about the South Carolina system here and how it's set up, because we have an email question from Karen. A Peggy email. Why does South Carolina have separate Democratic and Republican primaries? The Republican primary is this Saturday. The Democratic primary is the following Saturday. Why?
Because they can. Why do you hate America, Mike?
And apparently they also have the money to spend.
Because it's up to the party.
Mm-hmm. And it also keeps the spotlight going for a couple of weeks, doesn't it?
I have no problem with that either.
Yeah.
But the national party sits in there in negotiation with a lot of the other states. You know, New Hampshire is always going to be the first in the nation primary. Iowa is going to be the first in the nation caucus. But there's always room for negotiation. And we clearly see that this time with Nevada. Nevada is before South Carolina for the Democrats, obviously not for the Republicans. So it has to do with party negotiations and both of the official parties in South Carolina, yes, absolutely wanting to maintain their place and willing to jockey it around if necessary. But yes, if you're a South Carolina taxpayer, congratulations, we're all paying for two of them.
Yeah, and Nevada is actually even stranger. First of all, it's a caucus. And second of all, there's, I mean, at least with South Carolina, it's a week apart. It's easy to remember, you know, two consecutive Saturdays. In Nevada, it's a Saturday and the following Tuesday.
Wow.
So it could be worse.
How is it, are both primaries, the Democratic and the Republican primary in South Carolina, are they similar in how the results will end up? In other words, if you are a big vote getter, do you get it all? Do you get some of it? Do you get a percentage of it? Does it work the same for the Republicans and the Democrats?
The Republicans play it differently. Republicans, it's winner take all. So if you get a plurality of the vote, or they switched it up?
It's winner take most now.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That seems fair.
They only changed this cycle, though. And the ones before a certain date are now supposed to be proportional. But South Carolina being South Carolina, if you look on the door of my office, I have a picture of the South Carolina flag. And underneath it says, that ain't how we do things down here. So what we do is, even though it's supposed to be proportional, we're doing a winner-take-most. We're not doing winner-take-all this time for the first time. But you can win them all on the Republican side if you win overall and in every congressional district. You can get them all. So there is an easy machination towards it. But it's not automatically winner-take-all like it used to be. And, of course, the Democrats are far more always the proportional. And it's a different number of delegates, too. But, however, we still have – you know, really more delegates at stake in South Carolina than you've seen coming up already from Iowa or New Hampshire.
And Iowa had a lot of evangelicals who did the trick in the Republican side of things. I'm not sure how you would describe New Hampshire, but how would you describe South Carolina? What does it bring to the table? What challenges does it bring to the table for the candidate?
Well, South Carolina is the belt buckle of the Bible Belt. And so when you look at the Republican primary in South Carolina, something like 65% of the voters might identify themselves as evangelical Christians. So you're talking about that segment of the electorate being represented in much larger numbers here. But then you have other types of conservatives. So you have the social conservatives represented by the evangelicals. You have the people that are concerned about national security, terrorism. And what's interesting is that both Democrats and Republicans are reporting that they're very much concerned about national security. Mm-hmm. But I think that they would see those issues differently. But yeah, you get the national security folks, you have the social conservatives, you have your run-of-the-mill fiscal conservative, and so you get a good coverage of the different coalitions of the Republican Party.
And even inside that coalition, let's just take evangelicals, because they are predominantly the largest voting bloc for the Republicans, you see a very different set. Unlike Iowa, you can argue that with the right endorsement, you could see, you know, a relative lockstep, bigger voting bloc moving in. In South Carolina, it's extremely different. What motivates a Baptist from here in the upstate to, say, a non-denominational congregant down in the Lowcountry, they can be moved by very different issues.
Yeah, and we're going to have to come back to the evangelicals, because Tom's right. They do not behave like Iowa mm-hmm. evangelicals, and their voting patterns are extremely different.
We will come back to the evangelicals. We'll talk about the importance of the African-American vote in South Carolina in both primaries, but I would think primarily in the Democratic primary, and take a look at some of the important issues. I think we're also going to poll the audience here in the next segment as to what they think the most important issues in this primary are going to be and why they're going to the polls to vote. We have a Karen on Twitter who says, I'm going to vote in South Carolina primary because South Carolina is relevant and important. South Carolina chooses presidents. We have 10 seconds. Is that true?
Sometimes.
Okay, we're taking a break. We're coming right back.
If Karen says it, it's true.
Okay, if Karen says it is true, we're coming right back with more live from Winthrop University on Charlotte Talks.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to our special South Carolina primary edition of Charlotte Talks from Winthrop University from last night here on 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Dr. John Powderly at Carolina Bio-Oncology Institute in Huntersville, a cancer therapy and research center specializing in clinical trials for metastatic cancer. CarolinaBioOncology.org. And Leading Results, providing B2B companies with a marketing strategy and services for website development, lead generation, and inbound marketing in the greater Charlotte area. Details at leadingresults.com/WFAE. In his State of the Union address, President Obama outlined a lofty challenge for the nation: finding a cure for cancer. Vice President Biden is in charge of what has been dubbed the Cancer Moonshot, and he was recently in North Carolina to look at the region's contribution to the effort. We'll get reaction to this presidential challenge from some of the people in the Queen City who are on the front lines of finding a cancer cure when Charlotte talks tomorrow at 9 on WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, investigators continue to seek answers in the contaminated water crisis in Flint, Michigan. But experts warn millions of older pipes still in use put other communities around the country at risk as well. Efforts to assess and ensure the safety of America's tap water.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Scott Huffman, Dr. Adolphus Belk, both from Winthrop University. They're both political science professors, and WFAE's Tom Bullock, our political reporter here. And we are live from Winthrop University and Dina's Place. And we're going to hear from some members of our audience. Chris Miller, one of our producers, is here. And who have we here? Welcome.
My name is Malin. I am a current Winthrop student from Columbia, South Carolina. And my question is, why is it that Republican candidates are less likely to address their opinions on civil rights issues on their campaign websites?
In South Carolina, the South Carolina Republican primary will be 98% white.
Mm-hmm.
If you need more follow-up than that,
I'll go a step further, but that's it in a nutshell. I mean, realistically, what do they have to gain? Realistically, you know, you have to think in campaigning in terms of two real campaigns. Treat it like campaign finance laws treat it. You have a primary and the general election. Those two things can be very different. Does everybody remember when Mitt Romney's campaign strategist, I can't remember if it was chief of staff or who, made the joke about it's time for Etch-a-Sketch, you know, it's all over so we can shake it up and start again for the general? It's true. I mean, honestly, that was an honest moment of a politician or a political consultant speaking truthfully. So that's the key point, is it can only hurt them at this point.
But to May Lynn's question, I don't think it's going to take a whole lot of money to have a tab on your website where you carve out your position on civil rights issues. And I go back to Senator Lindsey Graham, who said after the 2008 contest, we can't be the party of angry white guys anymore because there just aren't enough of them. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the percentage...
Sure. It's true. But if you also look, Bobby Jindal said the same thing. And who are two people who couldn't get enough votes to stay in the race this year?
Yeah, well, I'm going to stay here hanging out with Senator Graham for a second, right? So if we look at the argument, I mean, the percentage of the electorate comprised by whites is getting lower and lower as we go on, and the percentage of the electorate comprised by people of color is expanding. And no one's saying that you're going to win a majority of African-American votes. But can you get back to 10%? George W. Bush increased his performance with black voters by 2 percentage points, getting into double digits from 2000 to 2004. And then the party just started backsliding after that. George W. Bush got 44% of the Latino vote in 2004. The party's been backsliding ever since. Can you increase your performance just a bit in a couple of contests so that people will at least begin to see you as a viable alternative? And I don't think it's requiring too much of people to have a tab on a website.
Right, but that's, you know, back to the point, you know, you don't have enough angry white men, but that's all that's voting in the primaries. The party as a whole came out and said that after 2012, and yet they didn't take those steps to truly reach out. You know, did they try and do a few things after 2008? They tried, and they mostly failed.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, we see the talk about reaching out, but then they realize who's going to actually show up and vote in the primary. Oh, well, certainly not anybody who would need an African-American towel. And the consultants they hire don't think, hey, you could reach a few new people by doing that. Should they have it? Yes. Can the party continue to grow if it's only catering to this? No. But can you win a primary by catering to that? Sadly, maybe.
And I will actually even go a step further. I would say that perhaps the question should be not just why they don't now, but should you be worried if suddenly it pops up for the general? Or should you take it at the same level of how you would see it now?
All the more reason to do it now so it won't be viewed as disingenuous later.
Right.
Okay, let's take one more question from the audience.
My name's Cameron, and I'm a high school student here in Rock Hill. And I was wondering, do you think any candidate on either side has a large millennial following similar to President Obama in the past?
Yeah, there's one.
Bernie Sanders.
The 74-year-old guy has the millennial following.
The old white guy who seems really angry seems to have the greatest following. It's sort of like the grandpa you want to pack a bong with, I guess. But he's having a following is very different than having voters. And that's the biggest problem for Bernie, is translating that enthusiasm of young voters, or young people, into voters. Let me point out, in the Democratic presidential primary of 2008, only 2.9% of the voters were between 18 and 24. And that's how the South Carolina Election Commission breaks it up. Bernie Sanders would have to not double, not triple, not quadruple, but quintuple that to really begin to eat into it. And that's unlikely, because anything that really drives out young people tends to drive out everybody.
Right.
I mean, Barack Obama actually didn't drive out more young people to the ballot box as a percentage. He drove out many, many more young people showed up. But guess what? Many, many more middle-aged people, many, many more older people. And the percentage of people 18 to 29 that showed up for Obama were the same percentage of people 18 to 29 that showed up in previous elections. Everybody's numbers were down before. Everybody's numbers were up this time. So for it to make a difference for Bernie, he has to have this following actually turn into voters in greater proportion than Hillary, or than older voters, are turning out.
And I, just to add one thing to what Scott was saying, which is absolutely right, and it's a key point to remember, is this. What do we know about Bernie Sanders so far when it comes to millennial voters? We keep hearing that he's absolutely just knocking it out of the park with millennial voters. But let's be very clear about this. Right now, we've had two states, Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary, and those two are two of the whitest states in the union, 91% white for Iowa, 94% white for New Hampshire. So really, right now, all we know is that the 74-year-old is really popular among white millennials. We haven't seen him tested yet at all when it comes to minorities, which is why Nevada and South Carolina will be telling. It will be telling in a way that I think sometimes people forget, because, and I'm the journalist sitting here, we in the media can oversimplify groups by not acknowledging the fact that we're just talking so far about a white electorate. You lose sight that President Obama brought out all kinds of young people and all kinds of overall voters. We don't yet know if Bernie can do the same.
But she asked about both parties. In the Republican Party, if there is anyone attracting millennials in significant numbers, who would that be?
Significant numbers? Nobody, but I mean, there are younger folks coming out for Rubio. Believe it or not, Bush has a younger contingent. I don't know about Trump.
You find them. I mean, look, I was in Columbia last week, and the two things, I mean, I stopped at every campaign place because they're all within walking distance. It's really funny, to me at least, that Ted Cruz's headquarters and Jeb Bush's headquarters are separated by a Hearst parking lot. Like, it's just, you can rent a car and get two very divergent views on politics right in the same parking lot. And you know, you walk into these places and you see volunteers. You see people who are about to go out and pound doors and make phone calls. And I talked to a few of them. And honestly, what you tend to find are millennials. You tend to find young people in, you know, Ted Cruz's office, in Donald Trump's office. They let me walk in and immediately asked me to leave. So I can't really go too much into that because I'm a member of the media.
I'm guessing time of day, and you're four blocks from University of South Carolina.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But what it boils down to is we know at least that Bernie Sanders is, in fact, getting these groups at least more attention. I don't want to make it sound like other candidates don't have that, but I can't say that they are relying on it as much as Sanders is, in fact, relying on it.
So in South Carolina,
if you look at presidential outcomes since the 1980s, you have to go back to Ronald Reagan for the last time that people under the age of 30 went Republican. So it's been a long time since Republicans have done well with young voters. And so I think that's part of the reason why, you know, folks are leaving them out there to be had, because if you had to put your limited resources to get the most bang for the buck, the unfortunate thing about voters under 30 is that they turn out at the lowest rate. So they're registered at the lowest rate, they turn out at the lowest rate. And so when resources are limited, people are going to invest where they think they have the sure bet, and that's dealing with voters above 30 and really dealing with voters above 45, because they're the most reliable when it comes to participating.
Yeah, but the millennials are now greater than the baby boomers in number, but they don't turn out and vote. the baby boomers, right. Y'all who are baby boomers, y'all ain't it anymore.
Surpassed.
It's the millennials. They are now bigger. Enough of y'all have croaked that the millennials are now surpassed you. But if they voted in enough numbers, you would no longer see political ads running on the Golden Girls. It'd be sent on Kick.
And the oldest millennials are in their thirties now.
Right.
I just want to remind you, Dr. Huffman, that this is NPR.
That's it.
And we are only funny on weekends.
That's right. Okay.
Wait.
I just want you to know that.
Well, you know that could change if you give to your local NPR.
Let's talk. I have a question from the audience here about the Bush family. Why does the Bush family, and therefore Jeb Bush, do so well in South Carolina? As shown in the most recent debate, South Carolina does not tolerate Trump's attacking criticisms of Bush. Why is that? And before you answer that question, the Public Policy Polling Organization came out with a poll of South Carolina voters. And they say that 38% of Trump voters say they wish the South had won the Civil War. 24% were glad that the North won, and 38% weren't sure about that.
Mean the war of Northern aggression.
That's right. So could that explain why Donald Trump, who also leads the public policy poll by a wide margin, 35 to 18% each, then we have Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and John Kasich, followed by 7% for Bush and Ben Carson.
Well, let me say this to the first part. Let's make no mistake about it. There is a segment of the electorate that's supporting Donald Trump that's animated by white nationalism and fear. And if we look at the sort of things that make it possible for these sort of white nationalist movements to emerge in our politics, increased or perceived competition from people of color, mm-hmm. and an eroding of the economic condition of white voters. And when you combine the ascendancy of Barack Obama with the Great Recession and its impact, that's something that's going to create a space where you can have this kind of blowback. We saw it during the 19th century with deconstruction. We saw it during the 70s and 80s with the pushback against the civil rights movement. And we're seeing it now against the rise of Barack Obama. And so when Donald Trump says, I'm going to be the candidate of your rage, some of that is also white rage. Now, as far as the Bushes are concerned, I mean, people might be suffering from some Bush and or Clinton fatigue.
Yeah.
If Jeb were to win or if Hillary were to win, we'd be looking at a period where from 1981 until however many years in the future, you had a Clinton or Bush somewhere around the White House, except for this, you know, 8-year respite of Barack Obama. And so some of it might be a little bit of fatigue.
And I want to unpack another part of that, too, is I don't think we can say that South Carolina has a love affair with the Bushes. I think at times there has been, you know, strong support for, you know, dad and brother. But we're waiting to see what they say about Jeb. And let's face it, when it came to Donald Trump's comments about, you know, who was president when 9/11 was it, you know, when 9/11 happened, the reality is it doesn't matter which poll that you look at, and believe me, the numbers are all over the place, but they have one thing in common, and that is Donald Trump is still defying what we would call political gravity and sitting firmly atop those polls. So you have to ask yourself then at this point in South Carolina with days away from a GOP primary, it's not hurting him. Bush is really hoping for third. I don't think you can say quintessentially that this state is still in love with the Bushes.
No, and, well, you know, and we can go back to telling great stories about Bush in the 2000 election. But I want to go back to something that Dr. Belk said. The folks who are mad because they are losing efficacy.
Yep.
You know, efficacy is the sense that you matter politically, that you have power. And to the degree that people feel that they're perceived, let me use the word perceive that is being taken inaccurately, then they are going to react this way. I'll turn you back to our December Winthrop poll. You know, we haven't been able to do a new one before the primaries, so our horse race numbers for that poll are utterly moot. However, if you go back and look, we asked questions, and this was a poll that sampled both landlines and cell phones for likely Republican voters. We asked them if they thought, whites were discriminated against, and even if they thought whites were discriminated against less than, as much as, or more than blacks. We asked them if they thought Christians were discriminated against. And the Trump voters, the people that are channeling this anger, felt that Christians were discriminated against. Now, South Carolina is 78% Christian. The nation is 71% Christian, yet they are feeling marginalized. 50-plus percent of South Carolinians go to church weekly or more. That number is only 36% nationally. So we, you know, that is the dominant culture here, yet it feels like they're losing power. You know, again, the same with whites. They felt like whites are being discriminated against, even though it's the dominant culture. So these are people who perception may not match reality, but they feel they're losing efficacy. They're looking for a voice. And as long as any candidate meets the minimum bar on that side of saying, I'm a Christian, I believe in Christianity, they can say things like 2 Corinthians instead of 2 Corinthians. And the evangelicals will still feel okay with saying, well, I wish he wouldn't curse and he should know his Bible a little better, but I need someone like that to fight for me. And that's why he's still winning among evangelicals.
Because evangelicals have been garnered. Politicians have been going after their vote for years and making promises and not following through. So why is it still working?
It's why, because of what you just said. Mm-hmm. Politicians. If you look at the volatility in the Republican field during this cycle, folks typically look for people with executive experience who might then serve as president. So if you were a state governor, that's seen as being a really good thing. That's indicative of your capacity to effectively serve as president and commander in chief. But you look at who's been at the top of the Republican field, a New York businessman, a retired medical doctor, and a California businesswoman. People are tired of elected officials. The way this voting thing tends to work is that we give you our support in exchange for an agenda that doggedly pursues the things that we believe in. And you've taken us to the, you know, you ditched us at the altar enough times where we don't believe you anymore.
Every time for the evangelicals.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
The evangelicals really only got mobilized, you know, in the 70s. And then in 80, when the election of Ronald Reagan was really going to be it, and the moral majority and Jerry Falwell, you know, repeatedly said that they felt let down, that he said all these things are going to happen. And the same thing when Bush courted them, the same thing when everybody has courted them. They have the only thing evangelicals do in mass is either show up or not show up. They do not coalesce behind one candidate generally. That's one of the things that makes the Iowa caucus different, but a caucus is not an election. In South Carolina, evangelicals will come out and they will vote for an issue, for a person, but not necessarily their faith. They're voting their faith. Would they have supported last time a thrice divorced philanderer and this time a thrice married philanderer? The fact is, theologically, you can make the argument that they're okay with it because the crux of Christianity is grace and redemption. And so there actually is a theological reason to say, I can support flawed people. But the reality is, they believe these people are going to fight for them because of what they sense as a loss of efficacy.
Donald Trump. We have a question from the audience about Donald Trump. I'll just read the question. We don't have time for the answer, I don't think. But if Donald Trump... If Donald Trump gets the most primary votes, can anything stop him from getting the GOP nomination? That's from Charles in Rock Hill. 30 seconds. Who wants to tackle that?
I'm the expert at answering quickly, so I will say this. There is a big thing that's happening after South Carolina. That's Super Tuesday, the first time you will see multiple states having elections at the same time. A lack of a ground game could significantly hurt Donald Trump because right now he's able to pack stadiums and make appearances that may not carry him through.
We're going to take a look at some of the issues that people are going to be considering when they go to the polls, and we're going to poll our own audience here to see what issues are most important to them. When we come back, live from Winthrop University and Dina's Place in Rock Hill.
More of our special South Carolina primary edition of Charlotte Talks from Winthrop University from last night just ahead here on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings, LLP, a full-service law firm serving the construction industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation, partnering with clients in all phases of a project. Details at babc.com. And Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting Diavolo, Architecture in Motion, exploring the interaction of humans with their architectural environment and its physical and emotional effect. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, Beyond Flint, the safety of America's tap water. Investigators continue to seek answers in the contaminated water crisis in Flint, Michigan, but experts warn millions of older pipes still in use and communities around the country at risk as well. That's a topic on The Diane Rehm Show at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE.
When you're a personality, you gotta have a brand identity.
It's not from me. It's from hearing from the audience that I have been told that they see me as their awkward older sister.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, comedian, author, and actress Grace Helbig. Next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks live from Winthrop University tonight. Yes, tonight. And if you're listening to it in the morning, you're confused. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Adolphus Belk is with us. He is a political science professor and African-American Studies program at Winthrop University and a collaborator with Dr. Scott Hoffman, who is also the director of the Winthrop poll here. Tom Bullock has joined us. He's with WFAE News, our political reporter, and we have people in our audience who have some questions of the panel about the primary.
Yeah, I'm Kent from Fort Mill. And my question is, what are the chances for a brokered Republican convention?
We were just talking about that, actually.
Your timing is perfect.
Yeah. You know, the question was, is there, before the break, was anything can stop Donald right. Trump? And the fact is, he could actually pick up pluralities and go all the way into the convention with more votes than anybody, and it still end up being brokered. Unless he has a rock solid majority going in, there is still a chance to play with it. And I guess I'll talk about this. Technically, every state on the Republican side still has, I believe, 3 RNC delegates that they get to send in. Now, you should not think of them as superdelegates. They are not the same as Democratic Party superdelegates, okay? But those are still usually unpledged. And then if you get in and you have 4 or 5 people who have some delegates, you can see a brokered convention. Don't rule it out. I mean, unless he starts winning 45%, and then once the primaries flip over to winner take all on the Republican side, he would have to amass a whole bunch then. But I think Tom hit the really important thing is, of course, South Carolina is the most important. Let me just say that. But next, maybe we should start counting delegates on March 1st and March 15th. Don't forget March 15th, Florida, Ohio, North Carolina. The bellwether, as goes the Ohio, so goes the nation. Florida is important, and North Carolina is important because it's going to be a purple state. If you can say I can appeal to a swing state for the general election, that's going to be important too. So let's really start counting the delegates after the 1st and the 15th.
And I think the Republican establishment hopes that it doesn't get to the point where you're at convention looking at having to broker this thing. You know, Trump's really run an insurgent campaign. Like, if you look at the way that things have gone in the Republican cycle, McCain lost to Bush in 2000. 2008, it was his turn. And he had to really earn it, but it was his turn. Mitt Romney loses to McCain in 2008. 2012, it's Mitt Romney's turn. And even though you saw a lot of volatility in the second and third place people in the polls and in the finishes, Romney ultimately emerges. Well, Jeb couldn't run back then because his brother's numbers were so low that the Bush name didn't carry the weight that it had previously enjoyed. So he had to wait it out. This was supposed to be his turn. And to date, he's ran a rather lackluster campaign and has had a really difficult time getting any breathing room because of Trump's oversized personality. So I think if you're a mainstream member of the Republican establishment, you're hoping this gets sorted out much more quickly.
I want to go back to specifically your question about the convention, which is really important. There are two nightmare scenarios for the Republican Party writ large. Number one is a brokered convention. Conventions are simply 5-day love fests that allow everybody to coalesce around a candidate, and you hear how amazing they are.
That's because you're too young to remember when they weren't.
No, I am old enough to have, I wasn't old enough for 68, but I do know the difference. But there's a reason that they are the way they are now, and that's because of how damaging those were to the parties. Both parties do the same thing. The second nightmare scenario is, frankly, if Donald Trump does, in fact, go third party. Now, I would argue that for Republicans, again, writ large nationally, that having a brokered convention is the worst choice for those two because you really don't bring everybody together around a single candidate the way that you could even if Trump runs as a third
party. You could theoretically have both. He goes in with more delegates, brokered convention. He gets deposed. He says, you broke your pledge, I'm breaking mine, and I'm running as an independent.
Let me get another audience question here very quickly.
Hi, I'm Deb from Fort Mill. I'm curious how you think, or if you think, the death of Justice Scalia will have any bearing on this whole process.
Ted Cruz already has an ad out. No joke. It doesn't exactly say Antonin Scalia. It starts with a shot of one of the classic sculptures of justice. It talks about the need to make sure that our courts, our Supreme Court, is there to protect conservative views. And it brings up words like marriage and family. And it is absolutely about making sure that in the minds of his constituents or would-be voters, that they know that he would be the best to pick the kind of Supreme Court justice they want. We were talking about this before the show. I think that this is going to turn what has already been a wild election even wilder. And it could have down ballot, you know, ramifications as well and for senators and things. I mean, it's huge because it's a reminder of the tangible, generational changes that a president can make. Antonin Scalia was appointed by Ronald Reagan. Long after that presidency, he was still making decisions and helping to form opinions that were still changing this country. His successor will be in the same position. So it will be, it will be
huge.
It will be huge.
Two quick points about that. First, Ted Cruz is on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Mm-hmm. So not only does he have this ad spot, he's going to be a part of those deliberations, and now he has a platform where he can communicate with free airtime nationally. Mm-hmm. Second, it's very consequential because up to this point, George W. Bush got to replace Republicans with Republicans. Obama got to replace Democrats with Democrats. Now you have a member of the core conservative block on the court potentially being replaced by a Democratic president. So those 5-4 decisions that went one way on, say, Shelby versus Holder and voting rights, they'd go the other way. And so we're going to see a nasty, terrible fight about this. And the night that Scalia died, I tweeted, you know, his body's not even cold and the fight has already gotten rather nasty.
And, you know, as bad as I think it's going to be in the primary, I think this is going to be one of the biggest things in the general election, because if the Republicans are battered, bruised, not ecstatic about whomever they nominate, they are going to use this to turn out their base, because they're going to say, if we don't, we have this generational issue that's going to pop up. If we let a Democrat win, they're going to get to nominate. So I think as big as it's going to be in the primary, going to be even bigger in the general election.
We need to talk about the Democrats, but before we do that, I want to conduct a little informal survey here. We'll break out the old applause meter here and judge by the loudness of your applause of what you think the key issues in this primary are. What concerns you the most as you go to the polls in this primary? Is it terrorism?
I bet you never thought you'd be applauding terrorism.
I've never heard anybody applaud for terrorism before. Is it the economy? Education, meaning free college education or the erasement of student debt?
Faculty raises are in that, too.
Pardon me?
Faculty raises are in that?
No. Immigration. So what I hear is the economy is the loudest in there. Who thinks that the country is dangerously off track? And who is tired of established politics in Washington? Of those of you who are tired of it, whose fault is it? Is it the Democrats and the president, or the Republicans in Congress? Now, in fairness, before we started the show, we asked how many Democrats versus Republicans versus independents there were in the audience, and the audience is, because this is a college, predominantly Democrat. Is that correct? That is correct. Okay.
There were at the beginning of the show, there were a few Republicans.
Yes.
I'm not sure if they fled.
So there were
some here.
So let's talk about the Democrats. Hillary Clinton has a youth problem, which she hopes to overcome in South Carolina with the African-American vote. She's going to do it?
Well, some of those young people happen to be black. And when we look at Hillary Clinton's support with African-American voters in the state, she's enjoyed support there by a wide margin. So her favorability numbers in the state overall are pretty strong. Her favorability rating with African-American voters is even stronger. And that's something that bodes very well for her as we turn to the Democratic primary.
But according to some polls, African-American voters in South Carolina don't feel very good about the economic recovery. Their economic instability is felt, they say, more acutely today than prior to the recession. While white South Carolinians feel the state's economy has recovered, if she's out on the stump advocating a continuation of the president's policies, which she is, why will that make African-American voters feel
African-Americans
better?
African-Americans in South Carolina are less likely to lay the blame for a stagnant recovery at Obama's feet than they are at the governor's feet. And whites are more likely to do the exact opposite in South Carolina. So, they're also going to look at this and say, well, I'm a Democrat. Linked fate has got me here. I tend to think Democrats are going to do better. Morris Fiorina, political scientist, referred to these people as stand patters, that they stand pat with their party because they think the other party will just be worse. And Bernie Sanders, for all of his talk about economic inequality, he's coming to an area with stunningly strong Democratic ties, having never been a Democrat in his life. And that's a lot to overcome with just the message.
There's another thing, too, when it comes to Bernie Sanders. And this is obviously live Tuesday night. Anybody know where Bernie Sanders is right now? Morehouse. He's at Morehouse College. Why? There's a very simple reason. We talked about this earlier. He's done really well with millennials, with white millennials. He isn't really known in, communities of color the way that a Hillary Clinton is. And he's trying desperately to change that. And if you go back to Obama, if you go back to the way that the vote, the African-American vote in particular, went down for President Barack Obama back when he was still Senator Barack Obama, it was young African-Americans kind of convincing their parents to jump on board, that in fact this guy could be elected. He could be the real deal. And Bernie Sanders is kind of hoping to do the same. He is out there hoping to get his message out as best he can. Whether or not it falls on receptive ears is another thing. But as of right now, his biggest issue is, frankly, in communities of color, they just don't know who this guy is who stands at debates and hunches over and wags his finger a whole lot.
Well, and I go back to 2007. All throughout 2007, African-American voters were behind Hillary Clinton. And then Barack Obama wins in Iowa, and the black people got excited about him because the white people did. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow, this guy has a shot. And then people started to coalesce behind Barack Obama. What you've seen up to this point is that you've had dueling celebrity endorsements. So the Congressional Black Caucus PAC has endorsed Hillary Clinton. Sanders has picked up endorsements from people like Harry Belafonte and some others. But then you've seen people talking about their connections to the civil rights movement. Bernie Sanders, I was there. Hillary Clinton, I cut my teeth as a young lawyer with the Children's Defense Fund, which was an outgrowth of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. But more recently, you've seen Bernie Sanders listening to the Black Lives Matter movement and incorporating some of their concerns into his policy positions. And you've seen Hillary Clinton go to Flint, Michigan. And if you look at the address after New Hampshire, she was speaking in New Hampshire, but she was speaking to the people of Nevada and South Carolina, in particular those people of color. And why? African-Americans, but African-American women most especially, are the most loyal constituency that the Democratic Party has. And you have to do something with them beyond courting people in February or November and then forgetting about them soon thereafter.
So, to an answer to one of our audience questions, do you think Bernie Sanders is beginning to break Hillary's southern stronghold or her firewall, so to speak, or do you think she maintains a fair enough advantage? Does he have a shot in South Carolina, in short?
Well, I don't think minority voters are the firewall. I think superdelegates are her real firewall. And those are the people that don't have to follow the outcome in their respective states. They can do what they want to do. That's the real firewall.
She's got an 8 or 9 to 1 lead right now among superdelegates. Hmm. So that's, Dolph is right, that's her firewall. I think she is going to win in South Carolina. I think if he can really eat into that and do surprisingly well in Nevada and do really well in South Carolina, maybe losing by single digits or low double digits, he'll make the argument, I can appeal to minority voters. But the fact is that she's still winning it, and he's got the superdelegates right now.
John Kasich kind of surprised people, maybe even himself, in New Hampshire. Will he make an impression in South Carolina? Because he has to make an impression here, I think, to stay in this, doesn't he?
What's tough is that he's the sort of candidate that would do well in a general.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he would give Hillary a run for
money. He would do well in a general. He's the kind of candidate, executive experience in a big swing state. A record of legislative achievement, right? That there are some things that he has that some of these other people that are at the top don't have. Mm-hmm. But you have to survive the primaries. And when you talk about the primary electorate, it's going to be more ideologically charged. And when you have so many candidates with so few distinctions between them, it's bound to turn personal.
Right. You come to South Carolina, as Dolph said, buckle the Bible belt, anti-Obama territory, and you say, as governor, I expanded Obamacare, I expanded Medicaid, and the reason I did it is because I'm a good Christian and you're not, mm-hmm. which is why the argument he's making. No, that's not going to go over well.
And you pointed out in the Winthrop poll that the candidates that you, this is in December, the candidates who came out with higher unfavorable numbers were in greater danger. And the two candidates, if I'm right about this, the highest unfavorable numbers were Jeb Bush at 41%, and John Kasich at 31%, which may in part be due to his people don't know him.
Yeah.
But what about Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio?
Well, they're so polarizing. I mean, he's ahead because his the people that are supporting him adore him. But the people who are against him don't just say, well, I'd prefer somebody else. They say, I hate this guy. So that creates a bigger gap. So he's channeling into something very different than the normal candidate.
Well, it's been fun. You've been a great audience. You've had great questions. I want to thank Dr. Adolphus Belk from Winthrop University and Dr. Scott Huffman for being with us as well, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. We'll do this again sometime. And are you going to vote? Get out and vote. Thanks for joining us.